It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, will we see a Joe Biden campaign for president? We'll hear the latest on the presidential campaign in our weekly roundup of national politics.
First, some communities that own and operate landfills in Wisconsin are looking for new ways to pay for their services. One idea being considered is a garbage collection fee, and it's one that the city of Superior approved last night.
Starting next year, Superior residents will pay a fee of $7.75 per month for the next 3 years. Then in 2019, the fee climbs to the originally proposed $9.75 a month. Superior's not the only city dealing with landfill budget issues. On the other side of the state, Janesville is considering changes as well.
Here with us now to talk more about garbage collection fees is Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So why exactly is the city of Superior looking to implement a garbage collection fee in the first place?
Well, it's become pretty costly for them to operate and run their landfill. It's cost them about $6.3 million a year to run it, and that's coming out of their budget. They've been subsidizing the landfill operations with roughly about $1 million from the general fund each year. And just with restrictions at the state level on levy limits or what they can bring in on property taxes at the rate of new construction, and then just with shared revenue funding being flat over recent years after cuts in recent history as well, it's become more difficult for them to maneuver and maintain the same level of city services that they always have.
We've got a clip here with Superior Mayor Bruce Hagan talking about the costs involved with the operation of that landfill.
We have other factors that are out of our control, like the tipping fee from the DNR, the fact that we had to build a cell last year that cost $8 million because of the necessity of the engineering, the criteria. On top of that, wetland mitigation that could cost up to $500,000 to $2 million, depends on the size of the footprint. We have a capping going on right now of the landfill we closed last year that exhausted its airspace, and that's $2.5 million. These are real numbers that it's very hard for myself and others and most people to get your arms around, because it just doesn't seem possible that you're moving some dirt and it's going to cost $2.5 million to cover it up.
So first of all, Danny, he used the phrase tipping fee. What is that?
Well, a tipping fee is basically what's charged at the gate at the landfill. And in the past, that's been used to pay for recycling programs. So they're paying about $1.7 million a year, I think he said. And so it's a big chunk. And they've maintained that if they didn't have to comply with that state standard or regulation, that they wouldn't be in this position where they'd have to implement a monthly fee.
And the mayor there pretty much giving a laundry list of fees involved in this, some unexpected costs along with expected costs. At the end of the day, how significant are the fees that rack up?
Well, the $7.75 fee per month, it when compared to other options that were on the table, it is less expensive. There were some proposals by private vendors like Waste Management. They proposed purchasing the city's trucks and their carts for close to about $800,000. And that would have had reduced rates for seniors, but it would have been a charge per can. And so they would have ended up paying more, and that would have been about $11.25 per can for a seven-year contract. So that people will be paying less for that, but it's still an added expense. And for a city like Superior that has a lot of older residents and seniors that are living on fixed incomes, that's a concern for some.
And this was a compromise, as I understand it. Originally, the first fee that was on the table was over $9.
Yeah, they had proposed a $9.75 fee per month per household, and that was introduced as a way to cover the deficit and maintain operations of the landfill, or maintain the landfill after it's closed, because it's approaching its end of life. They're expecting it to kind of close out by 2022. And so there's a whole bunch of costs that they would have to maintain following that. And that would be roughly around $150,000 a year to maintain that. So they're trying to keep all their ducks in a row.
So if this proposal for the $7.75 fee per month hadn't been adopted and approved last night, what other alternatives were on the table?
Well, I mean, other alternatives they could have considered were the privatization of that. So basically, they could have just taken Waste Management or some other vendor up on their offer, and people would have had to pay more for garbage collection than they would if the city was managing it. Or another idea was a pay-as-you-throw system that charges residents per garbage bag rather than per garbage can, so it would kind of encourage recycling in order to lessen the tonnage and tipping fees. The city of Janesville has taken another route with that. They did raise their fees in the past. Their fee is about $120 per household per year, and that covers garbage collection and recycling. But recently, they made some changes so that they're taking in more trash from a couple of surrounding municipalities and also private haulers.
Right. As you said, Janesville, another city that's in a similar boat as Superior there. City Janesville has been seeing less garbage being collected. What are the factors there behind that?
Well, you know, in the economic downturn hit in 2008, 2009, and so at that time people were building less, there wasn't as much construction, and so there was less waste going into the landfill. But then Janesville was also hit kind of especially hard because GM closed up shop, and that affected how much waste was being produced and the surrounding businesses that supported that as well. Plus, the council at that time in the city of Janesville was trying to reduce waste and promote more sustainable measures, more recycling. And so there's been kind of a shift as they've seen that tonnage drop off. And before, when it was always kind of a given that that would always be there, there would always be enough trash, when that dropped off, they didn't have a plan for a rainy day. And so now they're looking to bring in that waste so that they can supplement revenues and kind of take the pressure off of residents who are paying that fee.
Here's Janesville Operations Director John Whitcomb talking about those factors you mentioned and how it's affected the landfill.
So all of those things combined over a span of about 2 or 3 years resulted in dramatic reductions in tonnage at our facility, from a high of about 275,000 tons in 2008 to last year, not even breaking the 90,000 ton mark.
An interesting thing there, Danny. You think about increased recycling as being a good thing for revenue, though for a city it seems like it's a mixed story.
Yeah, it's definitely been that way for Superior and Janesville.
What have you heard from citizens in Superior up in the neck of woods where you are about how they feel about this?
Well, I think the councilors kind of show that mixed reaction to it. I mean, first it was voted down, and so I think nobody wants to see fees increase. Nobody wants to pay more for garbage. But when you think about some of the other impacts that it would have on other services that would be provided, I think that's what kind of pushed towards this compromise fee of $7.75 per month. Otherwise, you'd be in a position where you'd be possibly privatizing or just continuing to subsidize it through the general fund.
And are you expecting to see other cities in Wisconsin follow suit?
You know, the number of city-owned landfills in the state, there's only a handful. A lot of them had gotten out of the game when federal standards were changed in the 80s and 90s, according to Brad Wolbert with the Wisconsin DNR. So because it was so costly for cities or municipalities to keep up with those federal standards, a lot of them just abandoned it and private managers took over as the landfills reached their end of life. And so really, it's just Superior and Janesville that are really the largest cities that are dealing with this and trying to come up with ways to generate revenue to keep their landfills going.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior. She joined us to talk about the City of Superior's decision to implement a garbage collection fee and whether or not other communities in Wisconsin might follow suit. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we report out today analyzed data about teachers in the Milwaukee metropolitan area, including how Act 10 affected teacher training and retention. We'll talk to the lead researcher about the report's findings coming up.
First, there's been a lot of speculation that Joe Biden's name could end up on presidential ballots, and some Republican efforts could keep Donald Trump's name off of the ballot in key primary states.
Harry Enten joins us now for a weekly look at the latest in national politics and news from the presidential campaign trail. Harry is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot of buzz this week, Harry, about a possible Joe Biden run for president. Now, is this a real possibility, or is it just the sort of thing we get excited about in August when there's not a lot going on but won't really go anywhere?
You know, I started off thinking that this was just something that's being floated. Biden's name has been mentioned in a number of polls going back many months. He's the sitting vice president. He's never said he wasn't going to run, but it just always seemed like more of a fairy tale than something that might actually come true. But in the past few days, we're hearing more reports that Biden's holding meetings with fellow Democrats, that donors are potentially talking up raising money for him. So I don't put anything past him. I think the conventional wisdom is still that he's not going to, but the conventional wisdom is also pushing the other way. The chance of him running is increasing by the day.
You mentioned polls. Now, these are polls comparing somebody who is actively running and somebody who isn't. But based on that, what have we seen in a Biden-Clinton race?
Well, it's not good news for the vice president. Biden has consistently polled no more than 15% of the vote in most of the early states, and nationally, he's usually around 10%. Clinton, in most of these polls, is at around 50%, and Bernie Sanders, depending on which state you're looking at, is usually in the low 20s, though in New Hampshire, he's polling higher than that. So Biden is really in third place if you look at most of the polling data, but again, he hasn't declared anything one way or the other, and once he does declare, we should see some sort of a boost in his numbers. Where that puts him exactly, we can't be sure yet.
Now, you've written that Biden is buying time now, or Biden his time, if you will, to see if Hillary Clinton's campaign could be derailed by this State Department email story. So is he a candidate waiting in the wings for now?
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's running for president and then there's officially running. I mean, Biden is running in the sense that he's clearly thinking about it. He's clearly putting feelers out there. But if he doesn't think he can win or have a legitimate shot of winning, I can't really see him running. So he's going to sort of, as we say, Biden his time, and see where things are in the next few weeks to a month. And if Clinton's numbers, especially among the general electorate, continue to fall, and there's a feeling among Democrats, both the party actors, governors, senators, whatnot, and donors, that Clinton's vulnerable, then I think we'll see Biden get in. But if there's a sense that Clinton has been able to straighten things out and that she's doing well, I think it's far less likely.
Staying on the Democratic side, you mentioned Bernie Sanders. You and some of your colleagues at 538 did a thought experiment online. What would it take for Bernie Sanders to win? What did you come up with?
So I think, you know, the first thing that Bernie just needs to do is he needs to win both Iowa and New Hampshire. I think that's just so necessary, because if he loses either one of those states, then Clinton's going to head into South Carolina, where she does exceedingly well in the polls. But, you know, if she's been losing support among white voters and specifically white liberals, among African Americans, her support remains very, very strong. I don't believe there's been a single poll out this year that has Bernie Sanders doing better than 10% among African Americans. And if you look at who votes in South Carolina in the Democratic electorate, it's an overwhelmingly African American electorate. And Clinton is in a very, very good position in that state. So if Sanders is going to be able to win, he has to win both of those early states, and then a lot of other things need to happen. But it's, of course, possible. You know, campaigns are funny things. Who would have thought that Joe Biden would have got into the race 3 months ago, and now we're thinking that he may, in fact, get in. So anything's possible.
And suppose there's a Joe Biden in the race. Establishment Democratic voters are, some of them anyway, splitting from Clinton to Biden. Does that open a door for Sanders' more insurgent type of campaign?
Sure. I mean, it will certainly allow him a better shot to win more states. But the key thing to remember in all of this is all of the Democratic primaries allocate delegates proportionally. So if Sanders is still getting only a third of the vote, he's only going to get a third of the delegates. So that's part of the reason why it's just very difficult to imagine that Sanders is going to be able to pull it off. But if, say, Biden entered and then Sanders starts winning some states, that in itself creates momentum. He gets good press. Good press leads to more money. More money leads to more ads. More ads lead to more voters on his side, and maybe he's able to pick up votes. So I'd say Biden getting in is good news for Sanders, but either way, it's going to be an uphill climb for him.
Talking to Harry Enten about the latest in national politics and from the campaign trail, let's turn to the Republican side of that trail now, Harry. Some state parties, including North Carolina and Virginia, are looking to require candidates to vow not to run a third-party campaign if they don't win the presidential nomination. And I guess South Carolina already has something like that in place. Who do they have in mind there?
They have one person and one person in mind, and it's the one person that's on everybody's tongue, and it's Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump has blasted onto the scene, but if you go back and watch the Fox News debate or you listen to anything that he has said so far, he's been very hesitant to say that he won't run as a third-party candidate, and most of the polling shows that that would hurt whomever the Republican candidate ends up being if it's not Donald Trump. But I should say that there are reports out within the last 24 hours which do suggest that Trump is going to say that he won't run as a third-party candidate. And that's, of course, very important not only for the Republican Party in the general electorate, but it could also buy Trump some favor among Republican voters in the primary.
And he maybe has more incentive to make a vow like that as he leads in lots of polls around the country and states around the country. What are his prospects looking like?
Well, you know, this Trump boomlet is turning into a Trump summer, which could turn into a Trump fall and summer. You know, there were a lot of us, including myself, who, you know, who said, oh, Donald Trump, you know, lead for a few seconds. But the fact is, if you look at how long he's been leading in the polls, it is now longer than any of those boomlets we saw during the 2012 cycle, whether it be Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, or Rick Perry, who led and then fell off. His lead has already been for about almost 2 months now. So he's doing very, very well. But there still are a lot of questions as to whether, when more of the candidates start spending money on the air, as more of them get more press, can Trump actually maintain the lead? And, you know, he's still only polling in the mid-20s in most places. So at this point, he's certainly doing better. You know, his prospects look better than they did a few weeks ago, but it's still going to be a long trek for somebody who most of the party actors, governors, congressmen, don't really like.
And there's been a long-ish history, I think, of candidates looking real good until actual votes start being cast. I guess I'm thinking of Tim Pawlenty, I think Michelle Bachmann, Howard Dean, other cases like that. Could something like that happen with Donald Trump?
Sure. I mean, you could just go back through the history and just start naming people. I mean, Joe Lieberman, Howard Dean, even in years in which there's one candidate who's overwhelmingly doing very, very well, there's another candidate who looks like they're going to be an insurgent, and then they fall flat once the actual voting started, like even a Bill Bradley in 2000. There are just so many candidates that you go through the years and you say, oh, wow, they might take off, and then it all sort of falls apart. And the traditional metrics that we look at, you know, experience holding political office, being well-liked within the party, these types of things still don't look good for Trump. But the longer he holds out and the longer he holds that poll lead, and maybe, you know, you get someone like Jeff Sessions who stands on the stage with him down in Alabama, the senator down there, then all of a sudden you start twiddling your hair and you go, maybe.
You mentioned Alabama. We're seeing Republican candidates spending time in states like Alabama, Mississippi, Michigan, and others, a lot of them with primaries in March after the February rounds, the early ones in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Does this big Republican field open up maybe a new strategy where you say, the heck with those early states that everybody's going after, I'm going to pick out a few of those second round ones and make a splash there?
So, you know, what I would say is essentially that you don't have to win in either Iowa or New Hampshire. You don't have to win there, but you do need to keep your name in the news. The reason why these early states are important isn't because, you know, there's something very telling about what the electorate in Iowa or New Hampshire says. It's the fact that the media picks up whoever wins there, and then they get all this press, and then it starts a momentum train. Remember, John McCain did not win in Iowa, or come anywhere close to winning in Iowa in 2008, but then he was able to come fairly close. They said he was in a tie for third place, and then won in New Hampshire, and then won in South Carolina. It was all over. This year, it's the person who wins in Iowa and New Hampshire might only win with 20-25%. So to come in second or third, you might only need 10-15% of the vote. If you can stay within the news media, stay within the news cycle, keep your name getting out there, then yes, you don't have to win one of these early states. You only need to do fairly well, and then you can go to the South or wherever your particular candidate's doing well and win there and crush. So this year could be a very unique cycle in that, but you still have to do at least decently well in Iowa and New Hampshire in order to win the nomination.
So if I'm finding myself coming in 9th and 12th and 14th in those first three, maybe it's time to pack it in?
Yeah, I mean, Rudy Giuliani tried this in 2008, you know, on the Republican side. It was a fairly crowded field then as well. You know, no candidate won with more than, I think, 36% of the vote. I think McCain won 36% of the vote in New Hampshire, and that was the highest out of the early states. And then Rudy thought, oh, I'll just wait till Florida. It doesn't work. When Rudy finished near the bottom in, you know, the early states, it didn't work for him. You need to at least finish somewhere relatively well, keep your name in the news. If you don't do that, You're adios, amigos.
Let's end with the impact of Donald Trump on the other Republican candidates. We've seen some of them, I think, start to change the way they talk, what they're talking about. Is he having a factor on the messaging from the other 16, 17 candidates?
You know, we've seen them certainly on the question of immigration, you know, perhaps take more of a line that is more against illegal immigration, maybe being a little tougher, stricter on it. But keep in mind, Donald Trump is not somebody who has an ideology that he sticks to no matter what. He sticks to the ideology that the voters are telling him will help him win votes. This is the Republican base that is saying to Donald Trump, this is where we want you to stand. This is how you're going to win votes. So if Trump weren't in there, there would be somebody else who would probably be saying the exact same things. And the Republican, you know, the mainstream Republican candidates would probably be being pulled towards positions that Donald Trump is currently articulating.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time for a look at the latest in national politics. Listen to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. A new report released today from Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum takes a close look at teachers in the city of Milwaukee and the surrounding counties. The report is called Taking Attendance, and it identifies trends and patterns in the teacher workforce, including how the adoption of Act 10 affected teachers.
Joe Yato is with us now. He's a senior education researcher at Public Policy Forum and the lead author of this report. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, we mentioned kind of the Milwaukee area. Can you spell out the scope of the report? What area are we talking about here?
Sure. We look at the four-county metropolitan Milwaukee area. So that includes Milwaukee County, Ozaukee, Washington, and Waukesha County. Altogether, that includes 53 school districts.
And big picture, what kind of things did you find out about teachers in those counties over the last handful of years?
Well, we started by just quantifying and asking how many teachers there are. And I should be clear that this is public school teachers. Mm-hmm. That does include charter schools, but it does not include private schools because our data source came from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. And altogether, in that four-county region, there were a little more than 14,000 teachers. When we looked at how that changed over time, pre- and post-Act 10, we saw that the region lost about 700 teachers over that time period.
And looking at the numbers, 700 teachers were lost in the Milwaukee School District itself. They account for the bulk of that teacher loss. Is that right?
MPS certainly took the brunt of that that reduction, although there were 28 of the 53 districts also saw a decline.
So one question I guess that would leap to mind is, are student populations going down in those districts and teacher numbers are going down to match that?
We have seen a reduction in student enrollments, a slight reduction, but the loss of teachers outpaces and is disproportionate to the decline in students.
So Milwaukee Public Schools in particular lost proportionally many more teachers than it lost students.
That's right. So over the five-year time frame, MPS lost about 4.4% of its student population, but lost about 14% of its teacher workforce.
So that's raw numbers. You also tried to look at the experience levels of teachers. What did you find when you broke that down?
We found that the largest group has less than 5 years of experience. So that makes up about a quarter of all teachers have less than 5 years of experience. We also looked at the age of teachers, and the average age is 43 years old. And one striking thing was that the average did not change over time. So what we see is that districts are hiring less experienced, but not necessarily younger teachers.
So they're hiring less experienced teachers. What are we seeing with the more experienced teachers? Are they leaving the district, retiring earlier?
We saw a large decrease in teachers aged 55 and over. So that part of the workforce declined by 20% over the time period. And that was kind of an expected outcome associated with Act 10. Many of those teachers had been in the profession for a long time, and their exit helped to bring down the overall average experience level of the workforce.
Talking to Joe Yeadeau from Public Policy Forum. He's lead author of a new report on teachers in the greater Milwaukee area, Milwaukee County, surrounding counties as well. And you just mentioned Act 10, Joe, and I know it might be hard to paint a causal link everywhere, but this was a snapshot before and after Act 10 was implemented. What kind of effects did we see it happening on this teacher workforce?
I think you're absolutely right that we can draw correlation, but certainly can't say causation with the data that we have. But we did see that reduction in the number of teachers. Another thing that Act 10 did was with the removal of the union pay structure, it created a free market of labor where teachers could move from one district to another, essentially following higher pay and benefits. So we've heard anecdotally from school and district leaders that teacher mobility was a big issue. We looked at that in our report, and we found that of the teachers who were teaching in 2009-10 school year, who are still teaching 5 years later, only about 6-7% were teaching in a different district. So we found that teacher mobility was not, in fact, a widespread issue.
And this was viewed in some ways as a positive or a negative. A positive, maybe. It allowed teachers more flexibility in where they worked, gave them more options to move from school district to school district. But the fear was that wealthier school districts could poach, in effect, teachers from less wealthy districts. So neither of those hopes or fears seem to be coming to fruition.
Not in a widespread manner. Even for some hard-to-fill positions like special education and science teachers, we don't see a large number of them switching district to district.
Another factor you try to figure out was the diversity of the teacher workforce in these four counties. What did you find there?
The teaching workforce is not especially diverse. Teachers of color comprise just 11% of the workforce, although students of color make up about 44% of enrollments in the region. Of the 53 districts we looked at, there are 16 that do not have a single minority teacher. Some of those have high populations of students of color. So there's a disproportionate impact there.
Let's break that down a little and focus in on Milwaukee public schools for a moment. How did the diversity picture look there?
The teachers in Milwaukee Public School were actually the most diverse of any district we looked at, but still, even there, only about 29% of their workforce are teachers of color, compared to their student body, which is 86% students of color. So even in the most diverse teacher environment, it still pales in comparison to the student body.
And then in the other counties outside of Milwaukee County, you mentioned some districts had no minority teachers at all, or in other cases very few, but still some minority student population.
That's right. For instance, there are 172 teachers in the Port Washington-Saukville district, all of whom are white, despite having about 11% of their student enrollment being students of color. A little closer to Milwaukee, Cudahy has about a third of their enrollments being students of color, and of their 186 teachers, only one of them is a teacher of color.
Why is that an important factor to look at, the diversity of the teaching staff and how it compares to the diversity of the students?
There's research to indicate that students of color being taught by a teacher of the same race can have increased academic achievement. And those results are especially strong for low-performing students. There's other studies that suggest that teachers of color act as role models for students and hold students of color to higher expectations and standards.
We're talking to Joe Yeadeau, lead author of a new report on teachers in the Milwaukee metropolitan area. It's called Taking Attendance.
We're taking your calls on this. How did Act 10 affect the teachers in your school district? If you work in a school, have you seen more experienced teachers leaving the profession? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the discussion and get to your calls after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We're continuing our conversation now about a report out today looking at trends in the teacher workforce in the Milwaukee metro area. We're talking with Joe Yato, lead author of that report.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of the findings in this report, a lot of more experienced teachers have left the districts, the profession. Is that happening in your part of the state, in the school your student attends, in the school you work at maybe? What is happening in your area? Call 800-642-1234. And the role of Act 10, do you think it changed the morale picture, the compensation picture enough to lead people out of the profession, keep people from getting into it in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Joe, that issue of younger teachers getting into the profession, I know you didn't go into that specifically in your report, but you noted that when these experienced teachers aren't being replaced necessarily by kids just out of college, but by less experienced but average age teachers. Could that be part of it, that pool of new teachers isn't coming in?
That's something that we did not look at this report, but we do plan on focusing on another report in this series. It will be dedicated specifically to the teacher pipeline. Just simply to answer the question, are we facing a teacher shortage in the next few years? So we will be looking at enrollments of teacher preparation programs around the state, as well as the number and percentage of the workforce who are heading towards what you might term a retirement zone in the next 5 to 10 years.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Kaylee on the line in Milwaukee. Kaylee, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Kaylee?
I'm a teacher at Milwaukee Public Schools. A very large high school, and I just wanted to comment about the number of teachers leaving and the dropout of young teachers.
Yeah, are you seeing a lot of that at your school?
Yes, we are very desperate for teachers, and I'm extremely worried about starting this school year tomorrow, and we don't have any teachers to take up our classrooms.
And Kaylee, what are you hearing from the teachers who are leaving? Why do they say they're done?
There's a lot of violence at our schools. I think that's one of the main reasons. Having a lot of support from the administration is not really present in such a large school. And I think that young educators aren't prepared as much as they should be.
Kaylee, thanks a lot for bringing that up. So as you mentioned earlier, Joe, in your findings, a lot fewer teachers in the Milwaukee Public Schools in particular. Is this something unique to that district with the issues that Kaylee just mentioned of concerns about violence and not enough support to deal with those particular issues there?
I think there are issues not unique to Milwaukee Public Schools. It's things that we're hearing our concerns at other districts as well. But I do want to touch on one of the things she mentioned, and that's she felt teachers had a lack of support. One of the things that research points to as key in high-performing schools are the roles of principals and school leaders. And I mentioned a third report, but this will also be included in a future report from the Milwaukee Public Policy Forum, is that role of school and district leaders.
Kaylee, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Paula with us in Milwaukee. Paula, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Paula. Go ahead.
I had two comments. I wanted to say that, one, my daughter, who has been a teacher for 8 years, did not leave the profession, but she did, however, choose to leave the state as a direct result of the impact of Act 10 on teachers. She did find employment in another state, which is great, and it's really sad because she was a teacher who managed to have all of her students meet or exceed the benchmarks that are required of her A-12 students each year. And two, as an adult who works with many of the high school-age students, I not only don't encourage them to go into education, I actively discourage them from attending university in Wisconsin in the field of education because the outlook is so bleak and the morale is, in general, pretty bad.
Paula, thanks for calling. So a bleak picture painted by Paula and her daughter there, Joe. I don't know if you have that kind of anecdotal information, but is this a common theme, you think, about from teachers and people around them?
I think we do hear anecdotes. We try to stay away from anecdotes and stick to data and what the data tell us. That decline in teachers, we mentioned before, we can't say it was caused by Act 10, just that there's a correlation. But there are certainly any number of factors that contribute to that decline in the number of teachers over the last 5 years.
And this sounds like the exact sort of thing you'd want to look at in that teacher pipeline study. If people are actively being discouraged from going into the profession to be educated for the profession in the first place.
That's correct. We've reached out to a group of human resources officers at districts from around the region and plan to continue working with that group around some survey and exit interview data about why teachers are leaving their districts and why they're leaving the profession.
Paula, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Joe Yeado, lead author of Report on Teacher Trends, focusing on the greater Milwaukee area, Milwaukee County, surrounding county, the districts there. You can join in from anywhere in the state and tell us the story there in the schools. 800-642-1234. We have John on the line in Madison next. John, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that I was thinking of going back to school for teaching just about the time that Act 10, or just about the time that Scott Walker got in office, and then I was told I had an aptitude for it, and after Act 10 got passed and all the backlash and fallout from it, it just didn't seem like the right thing to do at this moment.
John, thanks a lot for the call. So there's that pipeline issue again, Joe. You're doing this report presumably for the benefit of the schools in part for their future. What are you hoping, Joe, that people take away from this and your upcoming studies to address these issues of the teacher pipeline, of the loss of experienced teachers, and more?
I think the first step is to know whether or not it's an issue. And our research, both this report and the future research, will address that just by quantifying how many teachers do we have, how does that compare with school enrollments, how has it changed over time. And with that knowledge and with the knowledge of what the pipeline looks like, our goal is to present that to school district leaders, to stakeholders, and to the public at large to have a larger conversation about what we want our teacher workforce to look like. Public schools schooling in general and teachers in those schools are a fundamental part of our community, and we need to continue to have teachers in the classroom for the health and vitality of the region.
Back to our callers now with Joel in Holman. Joel, hi.
Hi. I'm just curious if any other fields were looked at in this research, just because, like, for example, I work in skilled trades, and we have seen a huge decrease in the amount of viable workers and people in the trades. I hear the same thing from nursing friends. I hear the same thing from IT friends. So I hear a lot of people that kind of want to associate this with Act 10, but the teaching field is not the only field that we're seeing reductions and loss of skilled workers.
Joel, interesting point. Thanks for bringing that up. And Joe, you mentioned that this is a correlation. It doesn't prove that Act 10 is the cause. Is it possible that a loss of teachers, a teacher potential shortage, could be part of a wider skills gap that people are talking about in the state, not something unique to the teaching profession?
We chose to focus squarely on teachers and educators with this piece of research. It's possible that there are is a wider reduction. I know that there are organizations both in Milwaukee and Racine that are partnering school districts with the business community to try to provide a cradle-to-career pipeline to make sure that students going through have the skills necessary to hold jobs, not just those currently available, but what the jobs of the future will be like.
Joel, thanks for that call. Tony is with us next in Madison. Tony, hi.
Hey. Hi. My wife is trying to return to the teaching industry. She was a 17-year teacher. She is well qualified, and she can't get a job. And some of her friends are in the same position. Public schools won't hire her, often being told, "We love you, but we want a more moldable teacher." She had a long-term sub position where she was her student teacher got the job over her as a long-term sub in the Madison School District, and the student teacher wasn't actually qualified to teach the class.
Tony, thanks for that call. I don't know if you got into this, Joe, and I know you didn't look at salary issues because it would have made the data a little tricky to work with, but is there any sense in what you saw that schools might prefer a new, a young teacher, maybe cheaper, more moldable than that older, experienced teacher?
We did not look at the individual HR practices of districts, but we do think that that there is a shift, as I mentioned, towards hiring less experienced but not necessarily younger teachers that we did see play out across the districts.
We'll leave it there. Joe, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Joe Yeadeau. He's a senior education researcher at Public Policy Forum and lead author of Taking Attendance, a new report on teachers in the Milwaukee area released today. You can keep the conversation going and keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. You've got a link there to more information about the Taking Attendance report, and you can tell us what the story is in your part of Wisconsin, in your local school district.